to get suited up. Hi, I am here to read an excerpt of a short story that apparently wasn't so short, called The Return. I'm going to read you the latter bit, and the beginning bit that you're not seeing basically just establishes the main character. His name is Titus McKibben, and what you learn about him is that he is a missionary who's back in his hometown after a 10-year stint as a linguist in Papua New Guinea. So he's been translating the Bible into their language, the Wagyu language, and he's not so happy to be back. He kind of feels like a fish out of water in his hometown, which is a bit strange. So he's feeling unsettled and sort of emasculated by his choice. So the only thing that you also might need to know is that there's another character called Eve, and she has recently had a death in her family. Her father's just died. So here we go. Sunday was unbearably hot for everyone but the McKibbens. They walked into church cool and light while everyone else fanned themselves with church bulletins and wiped beads of sweat from their red faces. The air hung heavy and was so moist you could drink it. The sanctuary was armed with 5 household rotating fans aimed in every direction to keep the hot liquid air moving through the wooden pews and open windows. Their hum droned out the preacher's sermon about the temptation of Jesus in Matthew, and heat hung on lazy summer eyes that struggled to maintain focused on chapter 4, verse 5, verse 6, verse 7, verse 7, verse. Everything melted into lethargy. Even Preacher Dan, who was known for his occasional charismatic exuberance, seemed less animated, dabbing his forehead with a cloth as he stressed the words worldly temptations. And the babies, who cried only when they should be silent, had no need for shushing as they tried to sleep the heat off their skin. Titus allowed himself to be carried by the sound of the fans and the heavy current of air they produced, away from the sermon, away from Matthew in verse 7. He began to feel as if he were dreaming, as if he could now, finally, find the desire to carve a life into an elm tree instead of bamboo in this new world. Could he now shake off everything that had grown to belabor him? How Tingon, the first of their converts, had looked so confused, so disappointed when Titus explained that his family would be leaving. How the conversations with his wife had changed, begun to grow splinters at the ends of the words. How he would fall asleep, now, in this church, instead of constantly recalculating his decisions. In the heat, all his limbs relaxed and went numb. He tried to remember what it was like to be 21 again, before he left for the mission field with his new wife, before the 5 children, the bouts of malaria, the shamans, and all the magic and beauty of the Bismarck Range. Was this what it was like to be home? Before he knew anything outside of this sanctuary with the stained glass cross blazing gold and red on a Sunday morning? From the open window of the second level sanctuary, Titus looked down on the lawn. Everything was bright and hazy in the sun. His eyes scanned, tripping over the ripples of green in the grass, across the Hunter, Olive, and Kelly of each blade, then over the pure white of a dress and the warm flush of flesh. There, lying in the grass, was a young woman, reclining in a white dress. She was on her stomach, and he observed her shoulder smothered with auburn hair and watched her bare toes dig into the carpet of green. She looked grown there, like a giant orchid lying in the grass, the bloom too heavy for the delicate stem. He wanted to see her face, to touch her hair. She seemed like a ghost, and he watched her detached, as if he were gazing at a photograph taken years before. He couldn't actually touch her, could he? And slowly he could feel another wave of heat rush across his skin. That familiar heat, the dangerous warmth of desire. The heat created on skin that suddenly desires to touch and be touched. A cinnamon tingle, a blushing thought. Titus adjusted in his seat, looked down at his shiny new black church shoes. Then, his eyes drifted upward again, out the window, to see, just see if she was still there, if the white dress and the russet hair was still draped on the green bed. She was, but had moved, turned over so he could see the hollow of her hips, how they rose into a belly and higher into 2 swollen peaks. She seemed mysterious. He felt adventurous. His eldest daughter, Emma, pulled on his shirt sleeve, pulling him back into the sermon. "Daddy, we're praying. Close your eyes." She sternly whispered in his ears and then resumed her position of softly folded hands in her lap, head slightly bowed and eyes placidly closed. When the last amen was said, the Sunday school-aged kids came up through the staircase, showing off their crafts. Luke jumped into his lap while Ruthie hefted herself into the padded seat of the pew. "Daddy, look, I made an ark, and there's a giraffe and a beetle and a dinosaur. Ruthie said she didn't want to do it, and her ark isn't an ark." Luke pointed to globs of green crayon, indecipherable to all except him. Ruthie got in trouble, because her ark is bad. "Now, Luke, that wasn't very nice. I bet Ruthie's ark is very special. Now go show yours to your mother," Titus chided, lifting him off his lap, aiming him in the direction of the back of the church. He shot off with his colorful ark waving in his hand like a flag. Silently, Ruthie crawled over to him in the pew, handing him her ark. She looked up, her face red with tears collecting in the blue. "I just couldn't decide, Daddy." In Wagi, she continued to say all the things she wanted to put in the ark, things left behind in the move. Her accent was perfect, no traces of English. "But they don't have those things here, Daddy, and Miss Gates said I made it up." Titus looked down to a square piece of blank construction paper cut into the shape of a boat, with nothing but Ruthie scrawled in the bottom corner in red crayon. She buried her face in his side, pleading with him to take her home. He shifted his weight and tried to draw her small chin up to look at her face, but she pulled away and burrowed further into the crook of his arm. Titus could feel her inconsolable little body move with sobs while he held her. He wanted to tell her that he would put those things in his ark as well. He wanted to take all those things into a boat and sail her away from sadness. But he remained hinged on the word home. Had she meant a square bedroom with a trundle bed covered in a Barbie comforter, or a bamboo mat with a canopy of mosquito nets to cover? He carried her downstairs into the dining hall of the chapel, where his wife was talking to Kim Asher. "How's my little Titus?" she asked as he approached. "And who is this little angel with her daddy?" She touched Ruthie's curls. Ruthie didn't look up, so Titus twisted his body around so Kim could see her face over his shoulder. "And Ruth wants to go home. I'm going to round up the rest of the kids." Titus touched her shoulder to interrupt the conversation that resumed quickly, as if he weren't standing there. "But Titus, it's the potluck," she resisted. Kim chimed in behind her that Pam and Tim would be upset if they wouldn't stay. "No, really, I think we should get going. Lots to unpack still, and..." He trailed off as Anne grabbed his free arm and pulled him aside. She took Ruthie from his arms, and he could feel his body temperature lower as she unclasped from his neck. Ruthie looked at Titus, drugged to sleep by her crying, adjusted to a new set of arms, and then buried her face into Anne's neck. "Titus, we're staying. We can't just leave," she said in a low scowl, turning her back to Kim. Her voice had the same admonishing tone it had the night before they put in a request for furlough. How she had sternly insisted it would be good for him and the children to get back to the States. How she was worried about the way the children were picking up on the village's superstitions and animisms, and how the older men in the village had begun to look at Emma. To them, she was of marrying age at 12. There was talk of Titus staying on by himself, but Anne would not have it. They discussed it for weeks, and with each argument, Titus saw his control and her respect start to slip away. 6 months later, he boarded a plane for Iowa to save what he could. And just like before, Anne's persistence with the potluck won out, and Titus resigned to stay. So without a child to better shield him from awkward conversations, he wove his way through familiar-faced strangers to the bathroom. He was just about to enter the toilets when he stopped at the sight of 10 dusty, suntanned toes digging into the soft gray carpet. "I bet at first they were frightened by your green eyes, weren't they?" she asked as if they were already in the middle of a conversation. Her voice was clear and strong. Titus looked into her face, browned like her feet. He noticed she had a thin, gossamer-like layer of skin that was in the final stages of peeling on the rounded tip of her slender, freckled nose. He could tell he was taking too long to respond as he looked into her expectant brown eyes, but he couldn't speak, didn't want to. He just wanted to stand there and look at her, the girl in the grass who had tilled the soil in him as he sat in the hot pews of the upper sanctuary, the girl the stained glass had kept outside and him, upstairs, free to look at her. Yeah, they were afraid of our light eyes, white skin, our suitcases, all the things they'd never seen before. Anne and I were totally alien. He realized he had said Anne and I like it was one word, a complete thought. His expression searched for her identity. Although she looked familiar, he couldn't place her. You remember me, right? You have to remember me. Let's see, I was probably this high when you left. She lowered her hand to her hip and then turned around in the crowded hallway to grab a woman's arm. Mom, I was just saying that Titus has to remember who I am. Oh, don't be silly, Titus. It's my eldest, Eve. You remember Eve. She's just been to Bolivia for the last year of school. She was studying anthropology. Kim Asher playfully swatted him on the arm and then turned to rejoin her conversation. It couldn't be. Still, he couldn't believe it. Sure, he remembered Eve Asher. He remembered her as a 10-year-old little girl with scraped knees and missing front teeth. He remembered her wide eyes, silly questions, and obnoxious tantrums at not getting what she wanted from her mother, his friend Kim. He did not remember this creature, this woman with long auburn hair and tight tan skin. His hand reached out for her hair. Your hair, it's so long. They felt coarse against his fingers. Yeah, sometimes I thought I should just cut it all off when it got really hot in Bolivia. You know, short like when you left. I guess I was a bit of a tomboy back then, huh? But not completely. I had a crush on you when I was about that age. She paused as if she knew he needed a moment to let those words settle in his mind after the explosion they'd created. He liked how she spoke now, how her young voice had deepened into velvet. About your eyes, she said quickly, stepping over her last statement, returning the conversation to her original question as they took their place in the food lines at the potluck. I knew they would be surprised to see your eyes weren't brown. The school children I worked with kept touching my skin and hair, comparing it with their own. Guess they wanted to test if it was real. She giggled, tugging her hair at the memory. The potluck was in full swing by this time. On tables in the reception area, crockpots of various sizes were plugged into extension cords coiling into a mess at the outlet underneath. The entire church wafted with the comforting smell of homemade casseroles, bubbling baked beans, grilled meats, all layered under the sugary smell of chocolate ice cream and buttercream frosted cupcakes. Rows and rows of wooden tables and chairs were quickly filling with people's paper plates, piled high with hot dish, salads, homemade cookies, and half-burnt hot dogs and staling buns. As Titus plunked a spoonful of beans on his plate, he imagined little hands on her skin, their fingers running through her hair so different than their own. Their surprise to discover how real she was, discovering her. And as Eve's pink tongue licked a drip of ketchup from her thumb, Titus was jealous of them. He envied the explanation of their curiosity, their excuse to touch her, to see what she felt like. During the meal, Titus was annoyed by his two young children's constant need for his attention. Luke wanted him to cut up his hot dog. Ruthie wanted another glass of lemonade. A fight broke out between the two of them about who could sit on his lap. All the while, Anne and Titus swapped children from lap to lap, back and forth, like a rehearsed ballet, attempting to ignore the disruption of their conversations. But even Anne seemed to encumber him. Every question she asked Eve about her new job at the university and her new apartment in Uptown seemed stupid, trivial. Titus instead wanted her to talk more about the Bolivians, about how she had learned to dye skeins of yarn, of the noises she heard at night, and whether or not she missed it all. Everything else seemed meaningless. Everything else was hard plastic against the softness of a bamboo sprout. When she spoke about her adventures, he sensed each word, smelling the Amazon and feeling as if he was also caught in the sudden tropical rainstorm with her and her guide Lucho. He could see her excitement about that place and the way she spoke, and he wanted to keep her there, in that moment with her eyes lit up in passion. Eve was in the middle of telling them a funny story about a Bolivian man sitting next to her on the flight back to Iowa when her voice trailed off, and she excused herself to use the bathroom. As she walked away from the table, Titus felt pulled out of her mind and back into the church basement, sitting next to his wife and Miss Andrews, the church organist. Poor thing, such a sweet dear, Miss Andrews shook her head. You know why she came home, I'm sure. She had just accepted an offer to stay another year when Bill... She paused and sighed deeply. Bless her soul, she came home to grieve with the rest of the family. Eve didn't come back to the table. Miss Andrews told Anne and Titus about the funeral, about how lovely the family looked on the day of the wake, given the circumstances, and how she was asked to play It Is Well With My Soul at the funeral, Bill's favorite hymn. Slowly, people cleared their places and the children left to play games in a small field next to the parking lot. The men broke down tables and stacked folding chairs back into closets. The women started to put leftover food into disposable plastic containers and wash out crockpots. The day's heat began to subside as the yellow sun simmered low on the horizon like a pan of melting butter. When the congregation went outside to start the bonfire, the children were already running around with firefly sparklers in their hands. Titus digested his desire. His mind tripped over the Bible verses he'd learned as a teen, first struggling with lust. He who looks lustfully on a woman already commits adultery with her in his heart. And, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. The words intertwined with his thoughts of Eve. He thought of a little girl with a crush on a grown man. He thought of her now, her tight tan skin, and the little girl now in the body of a grown woman. He wondered if she still had the want to please him. His thoughts were wrong, full of sinful things he wanted to do, and although he knew he shouldn't entertain such thoughts, despite his reservations, he searched for Eve. He found her in the darkness of the upstairs sanctuary. She was balled up like a fist on the first pew, and Titus could make out the sounds of her tears. When she realized she was no longer alone, she quickly straightened, sitting straight, eyes closed, head bowed, hands calmly folded in her lap. He recognized the position from his daughter Emma, carefully rehearsed in Eve for years. Titus approached silently, eased himself into the pew like his bones were glass. "I guess I needed to get away," Eve offered after the silence. "I need to get away." Then she looked up at the stained glass cross behind the empty pulpit, now dim in the dusk. "Back to Bolivia?" Titus asked. She looked back down to her hands, and he could feel her guilt catch up to her, just as it had come to him before he left the village, and how it came to him again as he memorized the curve of Eve's breast straining against the white cotton of her dress. They each hung on her last words, in present tense, "I need to get away." She didn't want to leave Bolivia as much as he had resisted leaving the Wagi. "Why did you come home?" he continued. "My dad," she responded, as if there could be no other answer. "I had to, for my family." It was the easy answer that Titus had answered as well, but he wanted her to admit the truth, that she didn't want to come home, that she secretly resented having to leave. He wanted her to admit it for the both of them, and he wanted to feel the Amazon canopy of her hair and sink himself into the cool rivers of her skin. He continued, "But why, when you loved it so much, when it was your life, did you leave?" His right hand was touching her hair again, his fingers straying to the softness of her breast. She looked down to his hands, and Titus waited for her to say something, to punch him or kiss him, but she did neither. "It's not too late," he thought to himself, "for me to do the right thing, return to Anne and the children waiting downstairs." But instead, he continued to caress her in increasingly bold strokes across her chest and bare legs. His desire grew as his touch drew a sharp inhale of innocence and surprise from her parted lips. For a moment he thought she might scream, but still he waited without uncoiling his eager touch from her. He was repulsed by his own pleasure at these transgressions, and thought then he understood the truth about himself, about the responsibilities he had as a man of God, and he almost mouthed the words, "We are all becoming the demons and monsters that frighten us." She turned her face to him, and he moved to kiss her. But he soon realized her movement and accelerated breathing was not out of pleasure, but something else. Her eyes and tears rested on him. She looked into his face like he was a familiar stranger she was trying to place. In her velvet tongue and in a cool tone, she said, "Some choices are made for us by other people. They can take the things we want away, but to betray them would be unforgivable. And home is never again going to be the same way I left it." Then she slowly slid out from under his hands and stood up. She did not say another word, but looked down on him. She didn't seem angry, but her face was certainly changed. He couldn't pinpoint the emotion, but knew it had to be in one of those dark places near disgust and pity. Titus could hear each step she took as she walked the rows of the pews back to the staircase, slowly leaving him alone in the dark. The drone of people having conversations in the parking lot came through the open windows and echoed in the empty sanctuary. Titus felt foolish, remembering how she felt under his fingertips. He carefully thought about the homes they'd left, the ones that would never be the same. He went to the window and looked out at the strangers, lit by a glow of fire, waving white sparklers in the black dirt of night.